Could the next gold rush be in space? This hour, a look at a new venture that plans to use robots to mine precious metals from asteroids. Also, why Warren Buffett's decision to be tested and treated for prostate cancer has drawn lots of criticism. Plus, what happens to athletes when they get hit in the head over and over again? A new play called Headstrong tackles the subject of athletes and concussions and the lifelong effects of having your bell rung. The play's director, main character, and two scientists studying the effects of head injuries in athletes join us. All that in the pick of the week, the Pied Piper robot that's meant to swim with the fishes. It's all coming up after this break. Stay with us. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. And contact team sports, how well you can hit the other player counts for a lot. Body checking in hockey, getting your bell rung in football, that's the pleasant euphemism for getting hit in the head. Well, it's all just part of the game, right? Well, there's a growing body of evidence showing that those hits to the brain can do long-lasting damage to athletes' brains, damage that changes the structure of the brain that might be causing psychological changes like depression or poor impulse control, leading in some cases to suicide. So how many hits is too much? Should we do more to protect players, or is getting hit hard? Oh, well, it's the price you pay for playing in the big leagues. Those are some of the questions being asked by coaches, parents, and doctors, and they are questions also being tackled in a new play, Headstrong, that's opening here. It's open here in New York. It's going to be opening next week. And joining me now to talk more about it are the director of the play, one of the actors who star in it, and a couple of scientists who are researching what happens when you get hit in the head. Billy Carden is the artistic director of the Ensemble Studio Theater. He's also the director of this play, Headstrong. Thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Ira.
Actor Ron Canada plays aging football legend Duncan Troy in the play. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Ira, for having me.
You're welcome. Annegret Detweiler is associate research scholar at Princeton Neuroscience Institute. That's at Princeton University. Thanks for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Jeffrey Kutcher is the director of Michigan Neurosport. He's also the chair of the sports neurology section at the American Academy of Neurology and assistant professor in the Department of Neurology at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Kutcher.
Thank you, Ira. Good to be back.
Billy, let's talk about the play. It's almost like it's ripped from the headlines today.
It is a little ripped from the headlines. I mean, this was a play we commissioned from Patrick Link, the playwright, a year ago. He gave us a one-page proposal to tackle this subject, and I think he's a longtime football fan himself, and his family are all football fans, and he's managed to really take on the very tough questions that this issue raises in terms of how much we love a sport, but also what that may be costing the players who are playing it and how we reconcile that with ourselves and with them. So mm-hmm. it's the play, I think he's done a wonderful job of capturing that dilemma and really has created characters that really are very specifically portray the different points of
and
view.
And very true to life, as we who follow sports and follow this.
Right.
Know
I think it's
be.
I think it's very, you know, there's a wonderful authenticity to what he's written. And I think the character that Ron plays, Duncan Troy, is like an iconic football figure and, mm-hmm. and really in many ways embodies what we would consider the soul of the game. Mm-hmm. And that's very important.
Ron Canada, you do play that iconic football hero. And in the play, your character is upset of the attack on football.
Well, right. He's very much entrenched, Duncan Troy, the character I play, in the warrior ethic of football, especially as practiced at the highest level, the NFL. And he has excelled for 14 seasons. So mm-hmm. he very much wears the NFL shield, you know, on his heart. And he views anything that limits the manly characteristics of the game, the amount of courage that it takes to go onto the field, as an attack on the game and a way of life, as he sees it.
And he says, if you play football, one of the great lines I remember from seeing the play is, what happens if you take out the violence from football? You have Soccer.
He says,
well he's something like that, right?
That's in the conversation between the doctor and his agent who's trying to get a contribution of brains. But my character says, if you take the hitting out of football, what do you get? Checkers, which is a great dramatic line. I think what you get is a kind of chess, but for dramatic purposes, it makes the point.
Well, I think the other point is that Patrick makes in the play is that if you're going to have heroes, you have to have danger. Mm-hmm. And how do you not have real danger to have real heroes?
Mm-hmm. Right. But one of the points, the central point driven home, and it is sort of the conflict of the play, is do the heroes know how much danger they are in playing that game? And are they aware that there is the risk? Are they told about it? Is it kept secret? And I see that you're shaking your hand at this idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, this component is absolutely brilliantly displayed. And obviously the complexities of also what the effects of these hits, you know, mm-hmm. have in the obviously exhibited by the behavior of the role of Duncan, and then obviously with the death in the family and what this might provoke mm-hmm. as a complexity of ranging from tremendous guilt feelings to what the family has to put up with is mm-hmm. comes out really in mm-hmm. a very poignant way.
Jeffrey Kutcher, I know you haven't seen the play, but it deals with something called CTE that has been seen in some ex-football players. Tell us what that means.
Well, that's a great question. You know, CTE means different things depending on how you look at it. One way would be what are the changes that the brain is undergoing because of repetitive trauma that you see under a microscope on slides at autopsy when you can examine the brain once somebody is deceased. You see changes that are in a pattern that we think is due to repetitive trauma to the brain. What it means clinically is sort of the big question, is when the CTE start to produce symptoms in people, what do those symptoms look like, how do they progress, what is the disease itself? We're really just beginning to describe the natural history of what CTE means in a living person, and especially when we're looking at things that are very, very common in the population in general, such as depression and dementia, those things become difficult to tease out.
CTE is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, right?
Correct.
And let's talk a little bit more about it with Dr. Detweiler. What are some of the changes that might happen in the brain after a concussion?
So typically, I would say there one thing that is pretty established is the metabolic vulnerability that you has been demonstrated definitely on a research level in the brain after concussion. And there are neurometabolic changes that can be captured through an advanced imaging technique called magnetic resonance spectroscopy. And it measures in certain brain areas, and there's a choice where mm-hmm. it can be measured, that there can be changes in these neurometabolites. And they actually, as far as it is documented by now, they're definitely there until 1 month post-injury. There's an Italian group that has provided quite some substantial evidence for that. There have also been functional changes demonstrated by several groups. That's when a person performs, in general, typically a working memory task, because that's one of the typical symptoms of concussion that has been established clinically. I mean, one of many, but one that we can measure most easily. And there is evidence that these functional changes also persist.
Is it cumulative? Does it add up over the years if you're an athlete?
Right, and there is some very recent evidence that yes, they do obviously accumulate, and that's mm-hmm. the big question: how many hits are too many, and when do these possibly chronic traumatic encephalopathy changes occur? When do they start? And that's, I think, still a very open question, which we don't know. The other imaging modality, which might be maybe closest to capturing these more changes in the structure of the brain, is the diffusion tensor imaging, which where there is one study, there's, I would say, it's emerging evidence that there might actually be not only physiological or metabolic changes, but possibly structural changes in the brain. And that's obviously a very big mm-hmm. issue.
Ira, if I could clarify mm-hmm. a little bit about maybe two different entities that people are discussing here. One is concussion, and one is the chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Mm-hmm. And they're actually quite different entities, and we shouldn't presume that concussions are even related to CTE, mainly because what was being described as the metabolic changes that can be demonstrated have been demonstrated for up to 30 days after a concussion was diagnosed. That may not have anything to do with the more chronic changes at the cellular level. It might. We don't know. And so one thing that I want to be clear about is that the development of CTE does not require anybody to ever have a clinical concussion. Mm-hmm. It's more so the repetitive trauma force to the brain itself that probably leads to structural changes that lead to a degenerative process that then become CTE later in life.
That makes it even more mysterious then. If you do not get a concussion, if you're an athlete, you may think nothing wrong is happening.
That's true. And the point here is that, you know, a brain has to develop symptoms, has to produce a clinical effect to bring a concussion to the fore so that the athletic trainers and the physicians and even the teammates or whoever know that it's there. But do I think that if somebody has a big hit on a football field or on an ice rink and they're injured, they don't always produce symptoms. And so those people don't get the diagnosis of concussion, yet they're still injured. And that adds even another layer to the complexity of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if I may maybe add to that, also once a player has had a concussion and might become symptom-free, doesn't mean that things have normalized on the brain level.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's a huge issue.
All right, let me ask you, Billy, are your characters based on real-life people?
To a degree. I mean, I think two characters were inspired by two people who've done a lot of work in this field. One is Bennett Omalu, and the other was Chris Nowinski. And just for the record, Chris asked us not to mention him in relation to the play, so I want to respect that. Mm-hmm. But I think those two characters, you know, really inspired Patrick in terms of people who are involved in this and what they're learning about it. Bennett Omalu was the pathologist who first looked at Mike Webster, a very famous center for the Pittsburgh Steelers who died at the age of 50. And when Bennett Omalu looked at his brain after he died, that's when he saw the signs of CTE.
We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more with Willie Carden of Ron Canada, Annegret Detweiler, and Jeffrey Kutcher. Our number 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI, talking about concussions and the brain and also CTE, learning that they're two separate things. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. No need to be locked down to your laptop. You can take Science Friday with you. Find our apps in the iTunes Store and the Android Marketplace so you can really take this show and shove it right into your pocket. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about concussions in sports and about a new play at the Ensemble Studio Theater here in New York called Headstrong, directed by Billy Carden. When is it open?
It opens next Monday, April 30th.
And playing till?
It's playing till May 13th at 549 West 52nd Street in Manhattan.
Beautiful little theater over there on the west side. Ron Canada plays the legendary football player Duncan Troy. It doesn't look like it took you a lot of homework to get into that role.
No, I really didn't. I finally got a chance to use all this previously useless knowledge that I've acquired over 50-some-odd years of watching football. I saw my first professional football game in 1960. Johnny Unitas and the Baltimore Colts against the college All-Stars led by John Hadle, and it set me on fire.
Wow.
And
wow.
I've been sucking in information about this sport. I'm you know, addicted to it like a great number of Americans. But
you also realize, interesting, being in the play, you realize that you're making a choice as a football player, knowing what the consequences might be.
Right. The character, of course, is – making argues that everybody who gets on the field in the NFL knows the risk. And I've heard this statement made by many, many professional football players talking about, you know, realizing that mm-hmm. when they step on that field, anything can happen. And there have been, you know, a couple of instances, not too many, where there have been tragedies. Darryl Stingley paralyzed for life. They all know that that can happen. Joe Theismann's career ended horribly in one in second.
Right. But we're here we're also talking about people who are possible suicide victims because of getting hit too much in the head and suffering from depression and people dying in their 20s and in young lives that I think most people, Jeffrey Kutcher, don't realize, don't hear much about.
Yeah, well, I think we have to be very careful with that kind of assumption that the suicides and the depression that goes with them is a direct result of head trauma. I think in some cases it certainly is a risk factor. Mm-hmm. But like I said, it's being so common, being something that happens. We have to be careful not to make that link. We don't have data to support that that's what's going on clinically.
Can you ever get that data?
Sure you can. Actually, you know, one of the things that some of my colleagues and I are working on is a national sports concussion outcome study that is hoping to enroll athletes in many sports in their teens and high school, follow them through their college careers, their professional careers, and to death. And during that whole time, measuring cognitive function, measuring mood mm-hmm. scales and imaging, and getting a sense, and the impacts they're taking, the number of impacts, the degree of force, and being able to finally get a cohort study that will allow us to answer these questions and say, yep, this is how many hits is too many hits.
Can you have CTE and not have any symptoms of it?
That goes back to the point I made before, which is depending on how you define it. There have been some athletes who have died that have had the changes in the brain, who died from heart disease or some other issue, who had no neurological symptoms. Mm-hmm. It would be sort of akin to one of the analogies that's been made is, you know, you have some atherosclerosis, does that mean you have heart disease? At what point does it become a clinically relevant factor? I think you can have both. You can have CT and not be symptomatic from it, or you can have the more progressive, dementing neurological problem that I think is what people are describing.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, Billy, the play opens with a scientist who is trying to collect the brains of people.
Actually, he's not a scientist. He works with a scientist. Mm-hmm. But the character of Nick Merritt is actually, yes, he does. He comes to ask for the brain of a football player who's died from his widow.
Trying to, through autopsy, figure out what the brain damage is.
That's right, because right now that's, I think, and both our scientists can help us with this, but I think that's the only way we can really detect it.
Okay. Currently, that's essentially true. I think there are some advanced neuroimaging for tau that is starting to come online that will allow us to analyze brains in living people, but right now that's not a sort of ready for prime time technology.
Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Clayton in Austin, Texas. Hi, Clayton.
Hi, Ira. I know everyone's metabolism is different, but I think I've got a great example in myself and my brother. 40 years ago, I played college football. Probably had 3 or 4 concussions over the course of 4 years and never had any symptoms whatsoever. My brother was an Olympic boxer who, over the course of his 3 or 4 years, probably took hundreds, if not thousands, of blows to the head. And he had no symptoms for 20 years, and then they suddenly manifested themselves. And at this point in time, he has severe neurological problems and depression. And I think the fact that it happened so quickly and such a long time after, it was a real surprise to all of us.
Thank you for that information. Dr. Kutcher, any reaction?
Yeah, I think that actually illustrates two very good points. One is sort of the differing amounts of force or dose of impact over time and how that might give us different clinical outcomes. In other words, a football player versus a boxer, somebody who takes, you know, maybe a couple hundred or a thousand or so hits over a career versus many thousands. And the second point would be that every brain is different. Every individual brain is different. Every individual injury is different. And so if the brothers were reversed, if our caller had been the boxer, would he be in that position or not? And that, mm-hmm. you know, chances are not, but we don't really know that. I think it really highlights the fact that everybody's different in this situation.
You know, there's interesting stories coming out recently, and there was an article in the New York Times just a few days ago about soldiers who don't think that they're getting any kind of effect, post-traumatic stress disorder, seemingly tied to percussions, you know, being on the battlefield during things that explode a lot, and not realizing that may be connected.
Exactly, and that's another whole other set of forces that we need to understand how those affect the brain in a sort of subclinical sense. In other words, it's not producing an effect at the time, but when they come home months later, years later, is there a clinical effect that you can then measure?
What do you need to make the connection, and can we get to a point where we'll be able to? And I'll ask Dr. Detweiler also. To be able to do a non-invasive test of athletes and say, you've had too much, you know.
Well, we would love to have the test that could diagnose concussion but also diagnose CTE in a living person. The real issue here is it's difficult unless you're looking at a whole population and following them forward to be able to delineate out, to remove the other possible factors that could be accounting for these things. So you have to, you know, think about things like mood disorders, genetics, other comorbidities that could be contributing to each of these cases.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Dewan?
Well, I think that now not necessarily with regard to detecting CTE. I think there's a long way to go until we would have any objective tool available to us. However, to possibly come up with an additional assessment tool for sports-related concussion and when is it safe for a player to go back to play might be something more feasible and possibly an imaging marker, which we don't have yet, but we are working on it, down the road could provide that possibility.
Well, I want to thank you all for taking time to be with us today. Billy Carden, Artistic Director of the Ensemble Studio Theater. Also director of the play Headstrong, opens on Monday. Play for a few weeks.
Yes, until May 13th.
May 13th here in New York.
Yep.
Great play. I saw it this week. It's just terrific.
Thank you.
And the acting is terrific. You're terrific in it also, Ron Cannon.
Thank you very much.
And also thank you, Annegret Detweiler, Associate Research Scholar at Princeton Neuroscience Institute at Princeton. Thank you. And Jeff Kutcher, Director of Michigan Neurosport and Chair of the Sports and Neurology Section at the American Academy of Neurology. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ira.
Up next, it's the stuff of science fiction, spacefaring robots chipping away at nearby asteroids to extract trillions of dollars worth of precious metal. One company announced this week that it hopes to turn the idea into reality. The venture, Planetary Resources, backed by filmmaker James Cameron and a group of billionaire investors, including Google's Larry Page and Eric Schmidt, they plan to expand the world's natural resources by mining near-Earth asteroids. Eric Anderson is the chairman and the CEO of a private space exploration company, Space Adventures, also co-chair and co-founder of Planetary Resources. He calls himself an asteroid miner. He joins us from Los Angeles. Welcome to Science Friday.
How are you, Ira?
Do you have that miner's hat on with the light on in the front?
I don't. Right now I'm behind a computer looking at astrodynamical orbits and other sorts of prospecting data as we begin our search for the near-Earth asteroids that are going to be the most valuable for our missions.
I mean, this has got to be an expensive venture. Can you really make money on pulling in the asteroids and mining them?
I believe so. We wouldn't have started the company otherwise, but, you know, it is an expensive venture in the long term, but so is every other resource-intensive and extraction effort. I mean, these kinds of projects are over the lifetime of terrestrial mines and, you know, gas finds or oil finds and things like that. They're measured in decades, and they're measured in billions of dollars. And I think that ultimately to get the kind of resources out of space that will really make a dent in global GDP, you're going to have the same number.
And you say these are like the low-hanging fruit of the solar system.
Well, there's no doubt about that. So the near-Earth asteroids number about about 500,000, but we only know of 9,000. And the reason that they're so interesting, Ira, is because they are actually energetically easier to reach than the surface of the moon. So we've been to the moon many times, and the moon is a great place, which is very worthy of our exploration. But just to give you an idea of how close some of the asteroids are, they are easier to reach than our own moon.
Yeah.
So they're not way out there in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. These are,
right.
These are near-Earth objects, and they are very, very useful.
Yeah. What kind of metal? You're looking for platinum, gold? What's the holy grail here?
Well, there's different types of asteroids, and each type has a different concentration of different types of elements. So a certain type of asteroid is very high in nickel and iron. Those are useful ultimately. Another type is very high in water, which is extremely useful. Other volatiles as well, things like methane, which you'd know better as natural gas.
Well, let me stop you there for a minute, because we have plenty of water on this planet. I mean, do we have to go to an asteroid to mine it?
Well, the water that we would get off of asteroids would not be brought back to Earth. That would be used to drive an economy in space. So the great expense of going to the asteroids and going to the moon and other planets is, of course, the fact that it takes a lot of rocket fuel, and the fuel we have to bring from the surface of the Earth. So if we can actually source our fuel in space, it makes literally the roadways open for the rest of the solar system.
Oh, so these are like little fill-up stations, then.
We call them propellant depots, but yes, in layman's terms, it's a gas station. And for, let's not forget that water is comprised of two atoms of hydrogen, one atom of oxygen, and hydrogen and oxygen together form the best propellant fuel combination that we know of.
Yeah.
It's what powered the space shuttle.
Right.
And if you take, just to give you an idea of the scope, if you take a 50-meter asteroid, of which there are literally thousands, that is rich in water, that has enough water on it, enough ice, to have launched every single space shuttle that ever launched in the history of the space shuttle program.
Wow. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Eric Anderson, co-chair and co-founder of Planetary Resources. Those things would be very valuable, as you say, for space fuel. Added to the, on top of that, the asteroids might have valuable minerals that you can mine on them.
Well, there's no question about that. So I've studied at length the resources, the various elements that we have on Earth, and their abundances and their scarcity and their, the peak point that we project that we're going to be able to pull them out of our various terrestrial mines and what our reserves are. And you'd actually be shocked to see, when you really look at it, the number of different elements that are, we have only decades left, some short number of decades and others longer numbers of decades. But in my mind, to drive the prosperity of the future, if we want our children and really our children's children and their children to have the same level of prosperity that we in the West have, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that we're going to need to bring resources from space and add them to our economic base in order to allow that prosperity. It's not like we can't live without resources from space 100 years from now, but it means that we're going to be fighting over them a lot more than we are now.
Is that the timeline you're talking about, 100 years, or what is
it? Well, that's the timeline I think that would be fair to talk about in terms of bringing mass resources, like millions and millions of tons per year. But I think even on a scale of 10 years or 15 years, we could certainly be bringing back the most valuable resources, and that brings me to my point before, which was that the platinum group metals right now are thousands of dollars per ounce. I think platinum itself is $1,500 an ounce, and there are other platinum group metals that are more and others that are less. And these are really expensive metals. I mean, all of the platinum that's ever been mined in history would fit into a small box in the middle of a room, okay, so maybe 2 or 3 cubic meters. And yet it exists in these very high quantities in certain types of asteroids.
But wouldn't you be driving down the price of platinum if you start bringing it back to Earth?
I tell you, Ira, nothing would make me happier.
Is that right?
The story of aluminum, if it's a really interesting one, if you go and look it up, even though aluminum is 10% of our Earth's crust, we could never get to it until the 18th century because it was in oxides and we didn't know how to get it. And so back in the day of Napoleon's court, when he had his most VIP guests, he would pull out the aluminum and leave the gold and silver for the nobles. And then we figured out how to pull aluminum out of its oxides, and now we use it everywhere. And platinum group metals are no different. They're very useful in electronics, microprocessors, medical devices, you name it, catalytic converters, renewable energy. And I would love to see a day whenever that may be, when the platinum group metals are 100 times cheaper than they are now.
I'm reminded of a Twilight Zone adventure where they learned how to make gold and it was worthless. And that's another story. But take us through the steps for your planned stage. Where do we go from here and what are the steps?
Well, it's a three-phase plan. First of all, we have a technology roadmap that we've developed that lists every bit and every piece of technology that we need in order to go and extract resources from asteroids. We have some of that technology today and others we need to develop, and so we're slowly but surely piecing together and pulling together all the different pieces of technology that we need to have. Number two, we're going to do asteroid prospecting. And so this means that first we're going to develop a series of Arcad 100 spacecraft to go into low Earth orbit and study the near-Earth asteroids and make sure that we've found lots of the other interesting ones that are not yet found and look closer at the ones that we do know of.
And number three?
Well, part of number two is to go and send swarms of Arcad 300 spacecraft to these high targets, high-value targets. And then after number two, we'll choose the ones that we want to actually extract resources from. And then number three, phase three comes along, which is to go and extract those resources and deliver them to the point of need.
Good luck to you, Eric Anderson. I hope you get a webcam on those asteroids for us to follow along with you.
We will. Don't worry.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When billionaire investor Warren Buffett revealed that he had been diagnosed with stage 1 prostate cancer, the announcement reignited an old debate, and that was, why was an 81-year-old man screened for the disease? After all, it was just 4 years ago that a federal task force had recommended against the routine use of notoriously unreliable PSA testing in men over 75. But Warren Buffett also disclosed that he will seek radiation treatments in July, which is another controversial move, since experts say the long-term side effects of the treatment could be much worse than the cancer itself. And like many others, Laura Newman, author of the blog Patient POV and a medical journalist who has covered prostate cancer for 15 years, Laura Newman was concerned that other men might follow Warren Buffett's example. So she was so bugged that on her blog she listed 10 reasons why one of the world's richest men was making a poor medical decision. And Ms. Newman is here now in our New York studios to help us talk about that. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
What was so terrible about what he did?
Well, first I want to qualify that I don't know the specifics of his case.
Right.
I only know what hit the papers. And in general, there has been a movement away from treating particularly older men who really have little to gain in terms of longevity. The PLCO trial, which was a National Institutes of Health trial, showed that screening older men did not extend their lives at all. Mm-hmm. The treatments have some well-known problems. So my concern is that, he can pay for this himself. He's got all the money that anyone would want. But people pay attention to icons.
Right. But doesn't Medicare still pay for the screening tests even when you get older?
Yes, they do. It's going to take.
Think that's a bad idea?
Well, I think that this is a loaded topic.
Mm-hmm.
It's as loaded as it gets. You've got urologists who have been practicing treating prostate cancer and all things related to prostate cancer for, BPH and other things for decades. If you go to the annual meetings, they're focused on prostate.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, their careers, have something at stake unless perhaps they get involved in mm-hmm. urology that can really help people.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 if you'd like to talk about Warren Buffett's decisions and Laura Newman, who is here, of patient POV point of view. But as I mentioned before, it isn't just the screening that's controversial here, is it? It's the it's the seeking the treatment at his age that you have an issue
right.
with.
Right. I think some of the urologists are fighting back. Some of them claim that patients are demanding it, which I feel like the way the message is conveyed to patients has a lot to do with their choice. Mm-hmm. And what
do you mean by that?
If
you don't have the screening and you don't have the operation, you're a dead man.
Yes, that's one way of putting mm-hmm. it. But if you make your living doing surgery or doing radiation therapy, you are vested in that, and in a sense, you may not get the best information, the most unbiased information.
Because I've heard commercials that basically say that. I listen to the radio here in New York, and hear doctors advertising for that kind of situation. They say, "You want this thing out immediately," that sort of hype on the commercial.
I think that it's pretty well accepted now that most men will have prostate cancer cells seen on autopsy. Mm-hmm. There's an abundance of information that's come out in peer-reviewed journals in the past few years showing that the PSA test seems to be over-detecting.
Especially in older people, you're saying?
Right.
So what about younger people?
Younger, there are lots of question marks as well. There are many people who think that the PSA test in men who have no symptoms should be abandoned. Mm-hmm. But, I wanted to backtrack to the treatment side, which mm-hmm. you asked me about earlier, and that is that radiation, whatever kind it is, radical prostatectomy, often have sequelae that are not great. I mean, men have bowel problems. They can become impotent. They can become incontinent. It took years for urologists who really handle prostate cancer to begin to even look at these quality of life issues. And I think that came from some younger urologists who really felt like this was very important.
Sure, but shouldn't I be given that option to take that risk if I want to?
You mean to have a surgery?
If I'm facing choice, why shouldn't I be given that option?
Well, we live in a culture that actually treasures choice, but I feel that we're dealing with a healthcare system that is collapsing. And there are choices and there are choices. And why not put our limited healthcare dollars into health problems that can be managed well, where people will actually feel better and live mm-hmm. longer.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones to Bob in St. Louis. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Yes, I'm a physician. I think maybe she's painting the picture with too broad a brush. I think there's, we've got to really zero in on individual cases. I just was listening, and I thought of a gentleman who was a close friend of mine. He was about 80 years old. I found a nodular cancer in his prostate on exam, sent him to a urologist. The urologist said something that I find detestable. Don't worry about it. Something else will kill you before that does. And 2.5 years later, the gentleman had metastases all through his skeleton, and then they did procedures to try to keep his collapsed vertebrae from crunching his spinal cord and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Every case is individual. Now, I heard something on NPR about some new ultrasonic destruction type technique that in Europe, I think, that they're going to try here in the States. But, each case is a little different.
Laura, what's wrong with Bob?
And if I had it, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. If you had it, you'd want it done. You'd want everything done possible.
If I had it, I probably would opt, just like women with breast masses, a lot of them will opt for a total mastectomy, even though the statistics say if you got a lumpectomy and and radiation or something like that, you probably do just as well. But you know, doctors' wives have the mastectomies.
What would you do if you had the same thing you detected in yourself?
I'd really hunt around. I'd get about 3 or 4 opinions, and I would probably opt for something active.
Laura?
I think that it's very hard for people to think about not getting treatment because the entire healthcare system is built around treatment. And, you know, I've heard from men who have tried to join support groups and who have chosen active surveillance. And they basically tell me they kind of feel like they're not really welcome and they're like a fly on the wall because a lot of the support groups are talking about side effects of treatments, coping with incontinence. These are things that if you're on active surveillance...
Is that the old watchful waiting phrase?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, watchful waiting. Now right. They call it active surveillance.
I've seen a lot of complications. I was an internist gastroenterologist. I've seen radiation bowel disease, things of that sort. I've also seen a bunch of people that I thought probably lived longer because they had active treatment. And I know you said that at autopsy. I think in medical school 100 years ago they used to say that at autopsy, 80-year-olds or 90-year-olds or whatever, it was something like 90% of them had malignant cells in their prostate, what were determined to be malignant cells microscopically.
All right. Thanks for calling, Bob. Let's go to the phones to Rich in Minneapolis. Hi, Rich.
Hi. How are you, Eric?
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm a 75-year-old who got into a discussion with my urologist at the VA because he wanted me to undergo a biopsy where I'm borderline normal on my PSA and I don't have BHP. And he got very, very upset when I told him I wouldn't have nothing to do with undergoing a biopsy due to the sequelae. It was really interesting.
So you're not fearful then? You don't want to have everything that could be done possible for you?
I'm 75 years old and I'm on no medications whatsoever, Ira.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the point I think, Laura, you're making, if I don't want to put words in your mouth, is that they're at a certain age, you don't believe it's the literature and the advisement of the researchers is that don't have things done after a certain age, correct?
Right.
Well, the other factor in my behalf is the fact I'm a retired chiropractic physician and I read the research.
So you have a little
so
bit
I pay
of,
attention.
Yeah. All right. Well, good luck to you. We wish you well.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Rich. So your criticism, Laura, is not that people have the biopsy or they have the PSA test or they have the operation, but that there are certain age limits, and Warren Buffett represents a certain age group where most people say not to have that kind of stuff done. Is that right?
Right, right. I mean, that is really strong. Now, I do think that people who treat prostate cancer they're kind of not in a great position now because the data is getting stronger and stronger. But, you know, if you look back in history, I mean, I remember when every woman was getting radical mastectomies, right, and then a landmark clinical trial came out and everything shifted to lumpectomies. Now, I imagine... I don't have the data in front of me, but I imagine there was plenty of resistance. You know, you women are going to kill yourselves, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right.
So,
well, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Laura Newman, who is a medical journalist, written about the subject, 15 years or more? Seen
yes.
All kinds of stuff. And she's author of the blog, A Patient POV. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Up now is Flora Lichtman with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have you got for us today?
We're checking back in on a fan favorite
Ooh.
This week. It's the Robofish, part deux.
When
we last left. This is an amazing story. So we visited a lab at Polytechnic Institute of NYU, and it's a mechanical engineer, Maurizio Porfiri's lab. And a couple years ago, he shared with us this amazing video of his robotic fish swimming around a tank with little giant danios following it around, milling about the robot as it swam around. And this, you know, this sort of blew my mind. It combines two of my favorite things, robots and fish. So I immediately loved it.
It's a Pied Piper fish, right?
Absolutely. And when we did that video, which you can see on our website, he was sort of still trying to figure out just why the real fish followed this robotic leader. So here we are a few years later, and he has some insights into what's going on here. Mm-hmm. And what he found out is that it has to do with the tail flapping. So basically, and he designed this tail. This is not like a coincidence. I mean, mm-hmm. he designed the tail of the robot so that it moves water like a real fish would. And what he did is set up an experiment in his lab in this long water tunnel. And you have water kind of cycling through.
Right.
And you put the robot in, and then you put a real fish in. And you see if you change the tail flapping, what does the real fish do? And it turns out if you flap the tail at certain rates, at certain water flows, the fish always positions itself, or most of the fish position themselves, in this particular spot right behind and to the side of the robot. And anyone who's seen, like, Tour de France or, you know, race car
NASCAR,
driving. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Know what's going on here. The fish is drafting. Basically.
In the water, the currents are set up to pull you along. So the other fish position themselves behind the robot fish.
Yeah.
They draft the fish.
They draft the fish. It's a hydrodynamic advantage. And
it's
the question is here. Yeah. And he actually has, like, a laser set up, and you can watch the flow in slow motion of the particles. So you can see these little swirls of water being sent in the fish's direction. And they think that this is helping propel it. So the interesting thing is, you know, you see that in the water tunnel, but what does that mean for fish schooling and for this robotic fish? And he thinks that, you know, maybe some of this behavior has to do with this hydrodynamic advantage, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah. So by schooling, they're actually helping themselves swim.
Right.
The most efficient way.
Right. So the ones in the back may get an advantage by swimming behind a fish, but they, you know, pay the cost of not getting to food first. They also are safer because they don't get eaten first if a predator is coming right at them. So it's a complicated issue, and he's just looking at this one little piece, but
it's fascinating. The video is, I call it the Pied Piper fish.
Yeah, absolutely.
Robo fish and friends. It's a great little video up there on our website at sciencefriday.com. It's our video pick of the week. And
you can see this following, the milling about of the robots. One thing that he said that was really interesting to me is, you know, not every fish will follow. And so his next installment, so stay tuned, this could be number 3 in a few years, is to figure out how personality drives sort of the differences between the fish. It seems that the bolder fish are less apt to follow the robotic fish.
Yeah, they go their own way.
They go their own way, exactly.
Start their own drift.
Exactly.
And then, you know, they'll go in circles just like NASCAR. No. There it is. Up on a video pick of the week. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Ira here, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do, our radio show, podcasts, Facebook, Twitter, and more, if you appreciate that and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to contribute whatever you can by pressing on the donate button on your smartphone or iPad app, or going to our website at sciencefriday.com and making a tax-deductible donation. Thank you. Our program senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Namisha Srinanan. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Neil Rauch, our technical director at the controls here in New York. Our iPhone app is produced by Pastime Software.